Hello and everybody, welcome into the Fifth Dimension Podcast with me, Evan McDermott. Thank you for tuning in, and we have a great episode on tap for today. This week I spoke with Dr. Dennis McKenna. Dennis is an ethnopharmacologist and a pioneer in the study of psychedelic medicines. It was truly a pleasure to speak with Dennis. I mean, he's been one of my idols for quite some time, him and his brother Terrence. I mean, their work is really revolutionary in bringing psychedelics into more of a mainstream picture. I mean, we talked about the science of psychedelics, the medicinal benefits, sort of the shift in paradigm, and really the new way forward that they can represent. So I hope you enjoy this episode. Just a few notes before we jump into it. One of my friends launched up a new podcast. It is called Mind Bacon Podcast with Chris Berry. Do go subscribe on YouTube, as I'll be making an appearance on there soon as well. So don't want to miss that. Go subscribe on YouTube. If you're a fan of this show, you're a fan of the Fifth Dimension, do give us a subscription as well. Don't just subscribe to the Mind Bacon Podcast. Don't stop there. Subscribe to us as well. Your subscription, comments, feedback, ratings, whatever it may be, that social algorithm is how more people hear the show, how more people will find it, and ultimately how we can create a better global humanity that is interconnected back to source, how we can all come together as one. Unity is what we need as a collective, and that is what we are trying to bring through the Fifth Dimension. So if you're a fan, subscribe, 5-star rating if you like us, leave some feedback. I love to hear from you guys. We also have a Patreon, patreon.com/EvanMcDermott. It's under my personal name, and you can get access to exclusive podcast content, exclusive guided meditations. We'll have Discord calls and a great Fifth Dimension community. And you can get some free stuff just by subscribing to Patreon. So with that, we're going to jump into the episode, and I hope you do enjoy this chat with Dr. Dennis McKenna. Y'all ready? Welcome in to the Fifth Dimension. Psychedelics in the New Paradigm, a conversation with Dennis McKenna. And we're on the air. Everybody, welcome into the Fifth Dimension Podcast. I am joined here with Dr. Dennis McKenna. Dennis, thank you so much for taking the time to come on the show.
Thanks so much for asking me. Really appreciate it. Thank you.
Of course. It's truly a pleasure. I really, you know, for a lot of years, I've been studying your work, your brother Terrence's work, and, you know, you guys are really pioneers in, you know, the psychedelic movement, you could say. And so I'm excited to learn from you and, you know, spread some knowledge to the listeners about it, because I haven't had too many episodes on psychedelics itself yet. So I wanted to start off by asking, you know, with your own personal studies, usage, whether it be, you know, your own personal experiences mystically or scientifically, what have you sort of been able to learn about the nature of humans in regards to our sort of interconnectivity or our connection to nature, you know, through your interactions with these plants? And, you know, why might that sort of knowledge be so important right now, especially with everything we're going through? I mean, I could, you know, I'd be curious your thoughts on that.
Okay, well, that is a multi-layered question for sure.
Oh, yeah.
You know, people often ask me that question. You know, I've been doing psychedelics for many years, been involved with them for many years, personally and professionally as an object of scientific curiosity and study. And they say, what have you learned? Mm-hmm. You know, and the paradox of it is, what I've learned is how little I know. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, the psychedelics really remind a person of the limitations of their knowledge, you know, and kind of the realization that however much you think you know, it's not very much, you know, in a certain sense. And there's always an infinitely more greater amount of things that you don't know. And it seems like the more you expand your sphere of knowledge, the greater the great unknown out there expands to compensate it. And that sounds trivial and maybe even a little silly, but I think that that's the lesson. The lesson is that when I think psychedelics are a gentle reminder, and sometimes not so gentle reminder, that you don't, you know, whatever we think we know, it's a limited knowledge of the world, and we never will fully understand the universe, the cosmos, reality, or our place in it. That doesn't mean that we can't keep trying, you know, because the, you know, the reward is in the attempt. You know, it's kind of like a journey is not getting to the destination. The journey is what happens along the way. And I think as we all careen through life, you know, we are on a kind of journey, and we're putting together our own narrative. And so, you know, in that sense, I think that, you know, if people ask what is the main takeaway from, you know, from psychedelic experiences, is the realization and the willingness to admit that you don't have it figured out. You only have probably not very much of it, maybe nothing,
right?
You know? And so the other side of that is, you know, that might be very depressing to many people. It's like, well, I'm never going to figure this out. I don't find it depressing. I find it actually kind of exciting, because it means there's no excuse for boredom. You know, or you're never going to reach a point where you think, well, I pretty much got this figured out. And if anybody tells you they have it figured out, run the other way, because my contentious is nobody knows what's going on.
Right.
On you know, just about every level. And I think that's one thing that psychedelics remind us of, you know. And then, so there are other aspects to it too. I mean, people, you know, often do get this sense through their experience of the connectedness of things, and maybe a feeling of their place in, you know, this huge cosmic scheme of things. You know, and, you know, it can seem that we're very small. I mean, we are very small. We're, you know, an individual person is like a drop in the ocean, you know, a drop in the ocean of mind, if you will. We're an individual consciousness. But at the same time, through psychedelics, they remind us that we are connected to everything, you know, and we're all part of this, you know, this community of consciousness. Right. And which I feel is not, you know, I feel it's not limited to human consciousness. It's, if you will, it is the Gaian consciousness, if I can use that term. And I think that these substances are essentially messengers from Gaia. I like to think of them that way, you know, that they are messenger molecules in the biological sense. They serve, you know, neurotransmitters, hormones, and things like that within the body are signal transduction molecules. They carry a message, you know, and that's how they work. The same thing goes on in nature. You know, nature, complex ecosystems are really woven together. They are, you can think of them as super organisms. They're woven together by signal transduction processes. And signal transduction is obviously a signal, but it's a specific kind of signal. It's a signal that involves a chemical substance traveling from the emitter, whatever that is, to a target, you know, usually some receptor on the surface of a cell or whatever. So that's the biological sense of signal transduction. And if you look at any complex ecosystem, it's all tied together through the signal transduction processes, the plants, the fungi, everything else. They communicate in many ways, but they certainly communicate on this molecular level, you know, and so that is out there. And if you, I mean, it's interesting how many of these, you know, the psychedelics, for example, are similar to neurotransmitters, right? And so that's obviously why they affect the way the brain works, because they target those same receptors. But they probably evolved from an evolutionary precursor where they were, you know, they were signal transduction molecules in the ecosystem, you know, not for internal signaling, but actually for external signaling. And they've been, you know, repurposed and readapted to function as neurotransmitters. And it's just, you know, it's just the, it's the outcome of evolution. I don't know that there's any grand design, but it is the situation that we find.
Right. You know? So definitely, so
like that.
And that sort of complexity that exists that you talk about with all these, this sort of super organisms that exist within us. And it's sort of like,
within us as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's sort of, I found like, it's like that reminder that, hey, we are nature. We have this complexity within us. Cause I think a lot of times humans, we've been taught to really only view ourselves on this very much a surface level, shallow type of identity, whether, you know, it third dimensional identities, all these, this baggage we carry, all this conditioning. And so we sort of, we're very much disconnected from the source of nature, you know, especially, we were talking about, I'm moving to LA soon. I'm going to be in a huge concrete jungle, like the opposite of nature. Like that's, you know, there's all of, there's so much, there's so many people who have that disconnect. And, you know, I think psychedelics sort of have that potential, like you were saying, to sort of reestablish that connection and sort of give that reminder that there is so much out there that we don't know. And, you know, when we look at what do people need most right now in the world, it is to expand their lens and sort of evolve their consciousness and be able to look at things from sort of an abstract point of view, if you will. And I think the potentials of that is sort of where humanity needs to go if we are to evolve as a species, because I think what we're doing right now is clearly not working.
I agree. I think, I mean, the big problem, maybe the biggest problem that is the root of all our problems, is the fact that we have become, like you say, disconnected from nature, or at least there is that sense. I mean, you could say there's no way you can become disconnected from nature, because we are immersed in nature, like it or not, but we lose the sense of that connection, and the psychedelics can remind us of that. And that's very important. And one of the ways that, you know, we tend to, you know, build up around ourselves, we insulate ourselves from nature and other people, and even ourselves in a certain sense, by creating this illusion, which I sometimes call the reality hallucination. And now I think the more current, more neurosciency term that's applied to that is the default mode network, which is essentially something the brain does. It's a set of behavioral responses combined with memory and whatever comes into us through sensory channels and associations and habits and presumptions, and all of these things come together to create this model of reality that we live in. And it isn't reality, it's a model of reality. Fortunately for us, it resembles reality, we assume. it has practical uses, but then physics and other types of science will tell us, well, you know, actual reality, it doesn't look anything like this. But if we saw it, which we can occasionally when we see, when we take psychedelics, but it's very confusing. It's very hard to comprehend. So we construct out of practical necessity this model of reality, which we then proceed to inhabit. And most of the time, that's fine. You know, we're the producers and directors and stars of our own movie, and we create this internal narrative that is our being in the world moving through time, you know. But it's important once in a while to remind ourselves that that is, in fact, an illusion. Right. And psychedelics are good from that because they can temporarily disrupt this default mode network. They demolish these neural gating mechanisms. The brain, a lot of what the brain does, it keeps information out. You know, it's developed very sophisticated neural gating mechanisms to filter out, I don't know, probably 75% of what it would perceive if those gates weren't there. Right. Most of the time, we don't need to apprehend that. It's not of practical significance. You know, so it's easy to push it into the background, but that doesn't mean it's not important, you know. Mm-hmm. And at certain times with the psychedelics, they can disrupt that default mode network, and effectively they bring the background forward, you know. So you notice things in the environment that you might never notice before, you know, unless you experience them in a hyper sensitive state. Mm-hmm. I think certain people, certain situations, children, for example, or maybe indigenous people, they have many fewer filters, and it's kind of like they're on psychedelics all the time, you know, in a certain way that they have, you know, they perceive things. And it's not that, yeah, I mean, sometimes on psychedelics you see things that, you know, aren't there, right? I mean, couldn't possibly be there. But a lot of what it does is you see things that are definitely there, but you never noticed them before, or you never noticed them in the way that you notice them, you know. Right. So this ability of psychedelics to kind of temporarily disrupt this cozy little cocoon you create around yourself, this artificial reality, and actually look at reality in the raw to a certain extent, and also get this perspective on yourself, the ability to kind of step temporarily outside this cocoon, outside this artificial reference frame that you create. And that, I think, is the basis of a lot of the therapeutic properties of psychedelics, just giving you a way to look at your existential situation from kind of arm's length, you know. And if your issue is trauma or addiction or other types of things, being able to distance yourself from that and look back at yourself as though you were observing someone else, it can be tremendously therapeutic. It can be integrating, because then you can see, well, you know, this puppet, if you will, or this robot that I drive around most of the time, you know, is doing various things that are not helpful, not good for me, and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I think that's a lot about what psychedelics do on the therapeutic level.
Definitely. And it's sort of, it, like you're saying, it lifts that veil of what you think is reality. And you can sort of, it's like looking at yourself from a higher perspective, another person's point of view, and you can get to that, that root cause, if you will. I mean, I've been very, you know, I know you do a lot of work with ayahuasca ceremonies. I've been very called to partake in one of those. I've yet to have the opportunity to do that. I know down the line that'll be something I engage with. And I'm very intrigued by it because it sort of does, it lifts that veil in a way to where you can look at things at the root cause. And, you know, I'm very, you know, when we look at like Western traditional medicine, it's always about symptoms and it's always about sort of masking what it is that's causing, you know, let's say it's mental illness. If you have depression or anxiety or PTSD, a lot of times they'll just prescribe some sort of pill that you pop to make temporarily numb your experience of it. And what's intriguing about, I find, especially with like an ayahuasca ceremony or, you know, a shamanic healing, it is that direct root and facing that trauma, whatever it may be, and being able to move on from it afterwards and sort of integrate the experience of facing that, I think is incredibly important and something that we don't really emphasize as a culture. And that's something I want to see change. But I think that sort of threatens a lot of the, like, if we were to take that approach, it sort of threatens a lot of the constructs that we think is reality. It threatens a lot of the, you know, whether it be the pharmaceutical industry or the sort of corporative, you know, money making off of treating symptoms, and sort of threatens our version of reality.
Yeah, there's no doubt. Yeah, psychedelics are, I mean, it's exactly right. The current biomedical models for mental illness are kind of a joke in a certain way, you know. And it's partly because of the way that medicine is structured economically and you know, in partnership with the pharmaceutical industry. And, you know, if a person has problems, you know, they go to a therapist or they go to a mental health professional, maybe a psychologist or whatever. If they're lucky, they get 15 minutes with that person, you know, and then they usually leave. They expect to leave, and they are not disappointed. They expect to leave with a prescription, and they do, and that's pretty much the end of it. And if they're lucky, they get another consult with the therapist. But it's you cannot use psychedelics within this context. Right. You know, they won't work because they force you to look more deeply into your problems and get at the root of what's going on. And you need therapeutic help often to get those insights. So you need a skilled therapist who knows that territory and who is able to spend a long time with the patient, you know, I mean, and not just in the session, but leading up to it and during the session and then processing it afterwards. So it's likely to tie up a therapist's time for days, potentially. Well, that's not a very good medical, that's not a good revenue model, but that is what is necessary. And so I'm curious, I mean, I'm delighted that psychedelics are finally getting recognition for the therapeutic, you know, promise that they have. At the same time, I'm curious, how is this going to be integrated into medical practice? You basically have to completely reinvent psychiatry and mental health care, you know, in order to assimilate psychedelics. Right. And that's a good thing. That's needed. But will it happen? You know, and I think we don't know yet.
Right.
You know, judging by the proliferation of, you know, startup companies that want to bring psilocybin, or mostly it's psilocybin, but they want to bring psychedelics into the clinic in this way. You know, that's very encouraging, but I think in the actual implementation of it, there may be problems that haven't been anticipated. You know, how is that going to work? You know, the whole approach to psychiatric medicine, psychopharmaceutical driven psychiatry, you know, really harkens back to the notion 200 years ago, you know, or longer, but 200 years ago is about when it happened, around the turn of the 19th century. The idea that we're just complex machines, you know, we don't really have a mind and a spirit and all that, you know, we're just complex machines. And if we apply the right monkey wrench in terms of the right medicine, you can fix the machine. And all of that or much of that sprung from, I think, when it became clear that you could take something like opium and isolate morphine out of it. And morphine has many of the properties of opium, right? It's an analgesic, it causes euphoria, it's addictive, it does all these things. But it is clearly not alive. It's a crystalline inert compound, and yet it has these properties. And I think it led to a perception in Western medicine that everything can be reduced to chemistry, you know, and that and it sparked the beginning of the exorcism of the soul out of medicine, the acknowledgement that there is a soul. And you know, and this kind of medicine, reductionist medicine, kind of said, well, no, it's not like that. We're just complex machines. Find the right key and we can fix the machine, just like we might take the car to the mechanic, you know. And then along comes this generation of medicine, or these new medicines, which are in no sense new, right? They've been used for thousands of years in shamanic traditions, but this kind of, they're new to medicine, and I think they're best described, they're medicines for the soul. Well, so if you use medicine, these medicines in that context to treat the soul, you have to admit that the soul exists, right? And I think they are medicines for the soul, not only the individual soul, but the collective soul, and maybe even the planetary soul. You know, that's another thing that concerns me about, you know, the corporate co-optation of these medicines, which were formerly thought of as really sacred medicines with a spiritual aspect to them, a spiritual significance. Medicine is uncomfortable when you start talking about these things. They don't want you talking about spirits. You know, that harkens back to an earlier age, and yet you do have this sense that, you know, I mean, before there was plant chemistry, before there was phytochemistry, and people were isolating individual molecules out of plants, the earlier model was that, in fact, there were spirits in plants, you know, and that's the shamanic idea, that whether it's true or not, I'm not saying that, but that was the operating premise. And in fact, early, you know, chemical manipulations of plants were really motivated by attempt to remove the spirit or concentrate the spirit from plants. That's where the term spirits come from. You know, alcoholic distillates are called spirits, and it springs from an earlier age where they actually were trying to concentrate the spirits. This is how it was understood. And out of that came, you know, reductionist chemistry, basically from the alchemical roots to the reductionist invention of chemistry.
Definitely. And you know, whenever I talk about sort of science, and whenever you combine science and mysticism, there is always sort of that skeptical of approach of, oh, science, like spirituality, all of that needs to be separate. There's no place for it. But if you think about it, even science and sort of the scientific method in itself is a human construct that is from our own limited human perspective. Like we've created it almost in unison with our other constructs that we sort of live by in this reality. So there needs, along with, you know, all other facets of life that we talk about expanding that lens. I think, you know, science and the scientific method needs to fit into that category of evolution as well. We can't necessarily think we have this perfect scientific model per se, and I think it needs to be open for growth. And how would you say we sort of get that community to expand its lens as well? Because I do see a lot of pushback on that just from, you know, my own research. And I'm not even a scientist by any means, but I sort of encounter that whenever I sort of try and dabble the fields together, if you will.
Well, I think a couple of things. I think that for one thing, psychedelics can be a very useful teaching tool, especially for scientists, because science tends to be kind of arrogant about what it thinks it has figured out. And the reality is it has very little figured out. And scientists could benefit from being reminded of that. And I think it was Aldous Huxley who said, the people who think they know what's what don't know what's what.
Right.
And they should be taking medicine. They should be taking mescaline or whatever to remind them of that. So in one sense, I think it's very useful for that. And I also think that science as it is practiced today is I think that scientists should be forced, they should be required to take courses in philosophy of science. Because philosophy of science forces them to think about what is science, what is it really, and in this era of big science, where everything is driven by, corporate interests and finances and, grants and these huge institutions, and there's always a goal, we're doing this because we want the cure for cancer, or we want to split the atom, or we want to do these things. It's very rare that scientists have the luxury to step back and say, what am I doing here? What is this? And in its pure form, science is the search for truth. It's a tool that we have to expand our understanding of nature. And it's a very powerful tool because it gives us a tool that we can ask very structured questions to nature. We can put questions to nature in the form of hypotheses, right? This is how it's supposed to work. You have an idea about a phenomenon that you're trying to understand. You think, well, I think it works this way, and these things are going on. And then you can test that hypothesis against observation, against data. And, if it doesn't fit the data, then you have to revise the hypothesis or entirely throw it out the window and make a new one. That's the way science is supposed to work, but it doesn't happen in a vacuum. That's pure science.
Right.
Few people have the luxury to practice pure science these days, but we need more of it, and we also, again, because of this, we really need to, scientists especially need to pursue their craft in the light of the understanding of how limited our knowledge is and really how limited the scientific method is. This is one reason why I founded my academy. It's called the McKenna Academy of Natural Philosophy, not natural science, because I am a scientist, I value science, but I also, natural philosophy is what science was. It was the precursor to science before it became reductionist,
right,
and entirely preoccupied with quantitation and measurement. And natural philosophy, science evolved out of natural philosophy, but natural philosophy admits that there are other ways of knowing that are legitimate, that are not quantitative, not reductionist. And that doesn't mean that, we should just accept every cockamamie notion about how things are. It's good to be able to test hypotheses, and have some way to evaluate something. Otherwise, it's just a mess, and
right,
the craziest ideas will become accepted. And I don't think that's good either. That's erring on the other side. So, I think that psychedelics play a role in this, in teaching us a different way to think about this stuff,
Right.
and a different way to observe even.
Definitely.
A writer you may be familiar with, Simon Powell. He's written very interestingly about psilocybin and written three or four books. One of them was the psilocybin solution. I think the latest one is the Magic Mushroom Explorer. But in his second book, which I think was Darwin's Unfinished Business, he talks about how psychedelics can be a lens through which we view reality and notice things about it that we normally overlook, as we were saying before. They bring the background forward. And
Right.
these observations that you make by kind of removing the veil of your assumptions as you examine a phenomenon lets you appreciate it in a way that you didn't before, and actually gain insights about it that were not possible unless you were in this very receptive state that psychedelics create for you. And this
Right.
is this is legitimate. This is, we know, for example, that I think it was Crick or Watson. I think it was Crick who eventually admitted on his deathbed, practically. I mean, he always denied that he ever took LSD, but as he was getting on in life, he admitted that, and he admitted that his experiences gave him insights into the structure of the double helix. And Cary Mullis is another one. He won the Nobel Prize for inventing the PCR, the polymerase chain reaction, which was a huge advance in molecular biology and is used in forensics and all of these things. And he was quite upfront about admitting that his experiences with LSD gave him the ability to visualize what was going on a molecular level. He said, I could get down with the molecules and see what was going on in this VR artificial reality that he was able to hallucinate or visualize. And it turns out he was right,
Right.
and then so he came. So I think that in many ways, psychedelics are learning tools in that respect, and it depends on what the topic is, what you're learning. And there's a lot of discussion perpetually about what do you call these things? Are they psychedelics? Are they hallucinogens? Are they
Right.
mystical mimetics or whatever? And most of the terms are quite awkward and not totally accurate. And one of the reasons is that they can do almost anything because what they do is so dependent on set and setting. You can have almost any outcome. And
Right.
I was rereading Terence's book, The Food of the Gods, recently. And because I've been asked to write a foreword about it, there's going to be a new edition come out, and
Oh.
they asked me. So I thought I better go back and have a look at it. And I thought he talks about how these things used to be called consciousness expanding drugs. And maybe that's a good term, I mean, that's almost as good as psychedelics,
Right.
because psychedelic means mind manifesting. And it's deliberately a vague term. I mean,
Right.
hallucinogen is not right because
Right.
you don't always have hallucinations. They rarely do in a lot of them. But psychedelic is a useful term, even though it has all this cultural baggage, but
Right.
it's also kind of accurate to describe what they do. Whatever they do, they manifest the mind. not necessarily in the way you hoped, but they will manifest the mind.
Right. It's always in the way you need, you know, not the
always,
way you
It's hope. Always in the way you need. Yes, that's right.
Right. That's and I see what you're talking about with that sort of, I think that search for truth is a perfect way to put it. And I see a lot of parallels between almost sort of this, you know, we talk about the scientific science and like scientific method being a search for truth in about nature. And then there's these other ways we can search for truth about, you know, with psychedelics and through our own sort of personal experience, which it can be just as valuable as hard scientific data, you know, sort of mm-hmm. trusting your own personal experience with it. And I think that is vital for people to really take on themselves, because there are so many people who are not empowered in a sense and don't sort of reach this stage of self-actualizing and sort of seeking truth and looking to sort of fulfill their own potential and sort of contribute to the evolution of, you know, humanity. And I think sort of this lack of empowerment at a societal level has almost created the stagnation that we're kind of in with, you know, all of the division and all of the systems and structures. Almost, I mean, you could almost say a lot of them are collapsing because they're unsustainable. And and I think a lot of people are sort of like, oh no, what do I do? And don't necessarily know what to do. And that causes so much of the, you know, lack of individual empowerment that we see. And, you know, I think psychedelics are making this almost resurgence or reemergence because of the fact that it does offer that individual perspective of, you know, exploration and truth. And that's not something that our society really offered to us in a way, because we have commercialized and
not only offered but actively suppressed, you know. Right. I mean, Western culture especially has never valued inner experience. You know, I mean, Eastern culture is much more, you know, and because actually for whatever reason, they operate under this worldview, which is, I think, closer to the way things actually are. Mm-hmm. You know, this notion that we live in a world of illusion, the world of Maya. I mean, that is scientifically true. I think the viewpoint of Eastern philosophy and indigenous people is closer to the way it actually is than our view of it, you know. I mean, that we in the West, we lost a lot when we, bought into this illusion of our dualism, of Cartesian dualism, mm-hmm. you know, and we've been sorting that out ever since. And the dualism is, well, you know, the mind is out there. We can't say anything about it. We can only say what we can measure in the physical world. Well, that's obviously, so you're going to eliminate half of of the whole picture and just say, well, it's a black box. It's a mystery to us. It's not a mystery to us. We're living in it. You know, we're living in this bubble of consciousness. We're living in our artificially constructed realities. And we have tools like psychedelics to actually help explore that and understand it, you know. And then, I mean, and the insights can be valuable, but then you come up against the challenge, I guess, or the tendency of people to dismiss the validity of inner experience, the validity of psychedelic insights and all that, you know. And right. And some of them are, you know, really dumb. I mean, some of them are not insights. And, you know, after the trip, the next day or whatever, you look back and you can say, well, that was completely, you know, stupid.
Right.
But occasionally you don't. Occasionally you look back and say, that was an incredible insight. And that's the aha moment that you can come to that potentially can change your life, you know, can change a lot about your life, your behavior, or at least what you think you know, You know, so I think they're very valuable in that sense.
Right, definitely. And I think they also sort of offer that ability to, I think you mentioned earlier about sort of giving an emphasis on like, what is it that matters? What is our sort of priority? It's almost like a moral list. It gives you like a deeper sense of like a more, for me personally too, like a deeper sense of moralistic, my own, like what is truly my morals as a human being? And we can sort of realize, put ourselves outside of the box of that reality of, is everything about getting a nice job and owning nice material goods and having all, you know, all of this, these things that we are told are going to be fulfilling for us and lead to happiness. And it kind of, but you know, if you look at what is the cost of all of those material things, it is the destruction of the planet. It is, you know, we are viewing the earth as this finite resource. And, you know, when we sort of have this commodification mindset, and I think it gets you in touch with that, well, I am, you know, I am nature. I see the beauty of this planet. It opens us up to beauty. And I think it gives us that like moralistic framework of, you know, it is my duty to be a protector of this planet and work towards sort of becoming more harmonious with it and sort of
establishing, I think,
that symbiotic relationship.
That is the main message. That is one of the main messages that you can get from psychedelics. And I think this is maybe the reason that, because clearly we're way out of sync with nature, we're way out of harmony. And this is the root of so many of our problems, you know, the fact that we are estranged from nature in profound ways. Psychedelics provide us a tool to maybe get back to that place, or at least recognize the problem and try to change our response to it. And again, this is going against the cultural wave, because, you know, people don't like, you know, our culture does not like people who, not people, but I don't want to put it that way, but they dislike the idea of simply sitting quietly and going into your mind and thinking, you know, and the culture is so against that they provide all sorts of ways to distract yourself. And there are so many, and they're, you know, all these shiny objects, and nobody's immune to it, really. I mean,
right.
It's very seductive. It's very attractive. Sometimes you just have to push back and say, no, I'm going to find that core of stillness that is my being, you know, within myself. And of course, meditation and these sorts of things can do that. And people that can, you know, recover that place easily, spontaneously through meditation, more power to them. Some people require a little more than that, and that's where the psychedelics can come in. And then the benefits of meditation and that sort of thing following psychedelic experiences can be very useful, you know, to right. keep that integration going and so on.
Right, definitely. And I found that after having psychedelic experiences, I did establish a deeper meditation practice and sort of a yearning for connection within and sort of finding the true benefits of that. And I think if most people were to sort of engage in that in the psychedelic experience, would find that as well and sort of realize there is more to unpack within ourselves. How would, you know, when we look at sort of the systems we live in and all of our sort of constructs, what is sort of like the next steps for people to take to sort of realize, like, let's, you know, a big part of, you know, taking psychedelics, let's say take a psilocybin trip and, you know, you have these insights. A big part of that is integration and working and actually you might have these insights, but how are you actually going to integrate them into your life and sort of make changes? what is sort of the, like, the steps that individuals, like, need to take to actually create this, like, systems that more emulate nature and more in tune with nature? Because, you know, the cities aren't going anywhere per se. Like, we're still going to have cars and planes and, you know, all of these, a lot of these different things. And, you know, technology, it's a beautiful thing. Like, we're sitting here chatting online and it's, you know, having this conversation and able to share it with all these people. So what is sort of like the steps that need to be taken, like, at an individual level to create that change and embrace that change?
Well, that's the hard question, you know, and I think it's partly an individual thing and it's partly a collective thing. How do we, as individuals who have had these psychedelic revelations, how do we implement that in our lives? That is, you know, I mean, before the trip and after the trip, that's true to ourselves. How do we implement these insights? And really, I think that's also true on the collective level, you know, now, you know, and we see a kind of emerging consciousness that has been, you know, generations, several generations that have really been impacted by psychedelics. And I think it's helped foster the collective perception that, you know, we have to change as a species. We have to change radically, actually, because we don't, I mean, this is the unpleasant part, that, you know, these are wake-up calls. They're trying to wake up the monkeys, you know, and the monkeys don't wake up very easy, you know, and so it's like some kind of shock is necessary almost, you know, to really drive the lesson home. I think this is what COVID is, in a certain sense. I think that COVID is another messenger from Gaia, you know, a different kind of messenger. And it's one that nobody could ignore, this message, you know. And the message is slow down, I think. Pull your elbows in a little bit. Can stop this frenetic pace of consumption and you know, depredation of the environment and all these, try to get back to some place where you seek to find a balance in society and in yourself. I'm not sure what the solution is. I mean, you know, I very often say in my talks that ayahuasca and these other plant teachers are really trying to wake us up. And I think they are. I think they're waking up a lot of people, but are they getting out there fast enough? That's the question, because, you know, we don't have a lot of time left. This is what is worrying to me. You know, I mean, if we had had this conversation or been able to have it 30 years ago at the beginning of the 90s or something in that time frame, there was still time. Now time is growing short, and the homeostatic systems that maintain the planetary environment are having a harder and harder time of doing that, you know, because we're putting so much pressure on the systems. They're very resilient, but there is a point when they can't do it. They can't snap back, you know, without a radical change. Like, you know, half the people on Earth die or something like that. And that's not really something we want to look at as a desirable thing. You know, although realistically, maybe it is a desirable thing. And then, you know, that becomes a very tough conversation. You know, I do think that one of the messages that's coming from COVID is to try to focus more on community and on our local environment and the people around us and all that. In the global travel industry, and God knows I'm as guilty as anybody, you know, when it works, I'm always in motion. And last year I was doing so much travel, I'm beginning to realize, you know, you've got to stop or at least cut down. This is killing me, you know, was my message to myself. And then and then COVID came along and said, well, you said you wanted to stop.
There you go. You ain't going anywhere.
Ain't gone anywhere. So that's a gift, actually. I mean, to me, it's a gift just to have that time. Not that I seem to have any more free time, but at least I'm not moving around to different ways and with all the damage to myself and the damage to the environment that does, you know. Right. So I think that's one of the messages, is that we have to, you know, we have to refocus on our community, and that may be the model for survival, in a certain sense, because, you know, right now the global food systems they're run on petroleum, you know, and it's all about monocultures and, you know, essentially industrial crops, you know, and the strawberries we eat this morning were harvested in Chile yesterday and these sorts of things. That is not sustainable, you know, because one of the things is we have to stop. We have to get away from fossil fuels, you know, at least as much as possible. And, you know, in the coming decades, I think things are going to get more and more challenging, you know, extreme weather events, sea level rises, obviously greenhouse gas emissions. I mean, it's all kind of coming together as a perfect storm. Right. You know, and then on top of it, now we have this, you know, this awakening of people around the issues of social justice and racism and all that, which were always there and easily ignored. I mean, things would happen and then everybody's wringing their hands and then it all kind of settles back and, you know, we sweep it under the rug. But I think this may be different this time. I mean, it's not every day that you see something like happened after George Floyd's murder expands globally. I mean, we're seeing these demonstrations happening globally, and that's fantastic. That's very hopeful to me, you know, because what it is it's a pushback against racism, all these things. It's a pushback against this slide into authoritarianism, which is definitely happening. And you know, look at our country. I mean, our country's meaning the United States. I mean, we're well along the way to becoming an authoritarian state. Right. And the people that, you know, if we're not already, the people that think they run things, Trump and those people, they would love that. I mean, they really don't believe in freedom. You know, they believe in, I don't know what, they believe in a situation where they get to tell you what to think and you think it. And if you don't, you are a rebel. Right. And, you know, and I guess I'm a rebel. I guess anybody that works with psychedelics is a rebel. You know, I mean, Terence used to say that psychedelics were dangerous because they gave you funny ideas, you know, not because they're dangerous as drugs, but they engender unconventional thinking. And that's always a threat to the powers that be, you know. And so in that sense, too, psychedelics are catalysts for you know, exploring consciousness, but also reforming your perspective on things. So, psychedelics are definitely dangerous because they make you have dangerous ideas, you know? And I think that's the impulse, you know, and all of this, you know, the historical roots of all this are the Abrahamic religions, you know, which I could sit here and bash all day, because I think you could lay a lot of our problems at the feet of these Abrahamic, patriarchal, essentially authoritarian religions, you know, that started in the Middle East and now dominate the world. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and these religions, they have very little to do with spirituality.
Right.
You know, they talk about spirituality. They're really authoritarian systems. They're designed to basically tell you what to think and discourage your thinking for yourself, you know, I mean, because that's inherently threatening.
Right.
You know, so again, psychedelics are an antidote to that. That's why they had to be stamped out. That's why the Mediterranean mystery religions had to be destroyed, because it was seen as a threat to the authoritarian state religion of Christianity, which was gaining ascendancy at that time.
Right. And this like authoritarian state and the sort of powers that be, it's like they have their it's almost like their own bubble of consciousness, and they realize when there's a threat, when their bubble is in threat of being popped, they realize it, and they're going to sort of squash that threat. And you know, it's like psychedelics, it represents almost a new way forward, because it provides solutions to all of these things that you mentioned that we're facing as a society about, you know, why are we fighting against racism? Because we want to come together as community and to walk, we want to walk hand in hand and be as one. And that's what, you know, psychedelics does. It emphasizes community.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think we do need sort of almost a decentralization of our food and a decentralization of sort of like we're placed in these hierarchies of you know, amongst people, like we're not viewed as equal. It's all competitive. It's all, you know, we're supposed to fit into different classes and narratives. And
right.
I think just the psychedelics really break down those barriers and break down those constructs of what we think is identity and really,
yeah, you know, of separateness and all that. Yeah. Psychedelics, when you, one of the main perceptions is, you know, we are all one. There's no difference. What your skin color is, what your sex is, none of these things matter. At base, we're all humans, you know, and they do bring that perception home. So they, you know, make it easier to, you know, to form communities. And so, you know, I think that they are part of the solution. I am, so in some sense, I'm very encouraged by the fact that they're getting recognition again. They're not so stigmatized. People are beginning to realize they have some benefits, for at least from the therapeutic angle. You know, potentially they have the ability to transform society, you know, in ways that it really needs transforming. And the question is, does it work fast enough? You know, but
that's the million-dollar question, right?
I guess we'll find out. Yeah, I guess we'll find out.
Can only hope so.
Yeah.
I mean, so with that, we're at about an hour. I mean, we've hit on a lot of great talking points. So Dennis, is there any place you would want to send the listeners to, you know, maybe interact with your work more or learn more about, you know, whether it be
psychedelics? Yes, absolutely. I would. So I have started this nonprofit called the McKenna Academy. I'm putting the website there. So McKenna.academy or www.McKenna.academy. So it's the McKenna Academy of Natural Philosophy. And it's kind of the horse I'm riding now in terms of, as an academy, its mission is teaching and education. And a lot of it is teaching about these plant medicines. I call it a 21st century mystery school, you know, and it was created in the spirit of Eleusis, you know, which, I mean, Eleusis came to a bad end, right? But it was the longest existing mystery school in the Mediterranean, until it was sacked and burned by the Goths in 396 AD. But this, hopefully that will not be the fate of the McKenna Academy.
I hope not.
But I want it to be a modern analog of the ancient mystery schools, a place for the exploration and consideration of all kinds of great ideas that you might bring to the table. And the overarching mission is to understand ourselves, our place in nature, and so on. And so that's the idea. Sometimes I tell people it'll be the first academy in first mystery school in 1500 years, and probably the first academy in which you know, not all the faculty members are human.
that's beautiful. Well, we need more academies like that. I mean, I hope
more academies like that.
I hope more academies follow suit, and we start seeing, you know, maybe it becomes almost like a Maqueda Academy like franchise. We see them pop up all over the world, and
we've talked about this. We've talked about this, but that's phase two. You
that's
know?
Phase two. Get it started now. Get the roots going, that foundation.
Right. Right now, of course, I mean, a lot of what the Academy was going to do, what I was doing before, we'll get back to it, is to organize retreats and conferences in physical space and maybe do some of those in South America and so on. But since that's not happening, we're really focusing on getting a strong virtual presence online. And if you visit it, you can click into some of the cool things we've done in the last couple months, if you haven't already looked at it. And those things are, they're up there. They're not restricted in most cases. That, you know, anybody can access them. So take a look at it and put the link on your on your website if you can.
Sweet, definitely, and I'll have it linked in the episode description too. So everybody listening who wants to check it out, just scroll right down. It's right there, and you know, I'll put the link out there, and everybody can go and check it out. So Dennis, thanks again so much for coming on. I mean, I really enjoyed talking with you. I feel like I learned a lot, lots of process, and hopefully listeners are able to, you know, feel some empowerment. And
okay, you know. Well, yeah, it was great talking to you, Evan. You're a good interviewer. I enjoyed this very much, and we'll do it again one of these days.
Let's definitely plan on it. We can see what's the world's looking like post COVID or something.
Yeah, exactly. Check back then, and we'll see where we're at. If anybody's left standing, I think there will be a few. So
there should be.
I hope so. Yeah.
Big thank you to Dr. Dennis McKenna again for coming on the podcast. We'll have to do it again soon. We'll see what the world is looking like in the near future. And, you know, we'll talk again shortly. So I hope you did enjoy this episode. If you like us, as I said, give us a rating. Apple Podcasts, Spotify, subscribe, whatever your platform is. Drop that subscription, that feedback. I love to hear from you guys. We do have the Patreon, patreon.com/EvanMcDermid. I mentioned the benefits at the beginning of the show. Find us on social media at Instagram at Evan McDermid and at the Fifth Dimension Podcast. We use that page quite a bit. Give some daily wisdom, podcast updates, some great content on the Instagram page. So you should go and follow. I follow back. I love to, you know, interact with everybody on there. And with that, do subscribe because we have some great episodes coming up. The show is blowing up. We're getting some more of you know, interaction with the show than ever before previously, and that's quite exciting because I think, you know, we can really make a positive difference in the lives of so many. So if you'd like the show, share it with somebody who you think needs to hear it. And with that, it's gonna wrap up the episode, and I will see you next time. So long.